to all parties. We'll call case number 3, Appeal 05287, Patel versus Gonzalez.
Called my case.
Yeah.
My name is Mary Svashati. I represent the petitioner Rajendra Kumar Patel. This is a case involving an appeal from the decision of the immigration judge, which the board summarily affirmed, denying him asylum on the grounds that he wasn't credible. This is a case in which a young man from a small village in India, in the state of Gujarat, fled the village because he had been mistreated by several Muslim men who came to their home, his home. He was living with his parents at the time and beat him up because they demanded information about police movements. This is a man who also stated that as a basis for his claim of asylum, that he was a believer in nonviolence. He was a Hindu, and there was a great deal of communal violence, and he was the one who had advocated a great deal of peace and sought to ease the tensions between the Muslims and the Hindus in his village.
Now, he's not arguing that the Muslim men attacked him because he was a peacemaker, is he?
They attacked him because he was known to the Muslims and the Hindus in his village. He had sought police protection by being nice to the police as the violence increased in order to protect his property and his lives. And they viewed him as an informant.
Yeah, okay. So his claim is that they targeted him because they thought he had some sort of unspecified information.
As they were planning, Muslims were, some retaliatory acts against Hindus, because it was a period from 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, where there was a great deal of communal violence in the state of Gujarat. There was action and retaliation. There was between Hindus and Muslims. And I would suspect the problem that he had in communicating the essence of what these men were after was that he didn't know that they didn't ask him specifically, "We think you are an opponent of Muslims, and therefore you're friendly with the police, and we are now going to beat you up because of your political opinion." It's not that clear, and it wouldn't be that clear in a circumstance such as the one he described. But in terms of positing the backdrop for why he was confronted by these Muslims, he had testified very, very consistently that he was trying to get the Muslims and the Hindus to live together in peace. Hindus didn't like him because he wasn't promoting the BJP party's platform, which was quite evident at the time. The BJP party was fomenting communal violence. And the Muslims didn't like him because they suspected that as a Hindu, he was being friendly with the Muslims so that he could report their activities to the police. Now, we don't have a completely perfect record, but I don't think we're required to have a completely perfect record where your attacker says, "I'm attacking you for A, B, and C reason, and this is why I'm doing it." These men were thugs. And, yes, they wanted to know what he had told the police about, or what they demanded from him, police information on police movements. But that was a very, very tense period of time. And they believed in their heart of hearts that he knew everything, or that he had told them everything.
Do you want to comment for a moment on this credibility finding, an adverse credibility finding? One of the subsets of that, I guess, was the implausibility of seeing the same one of these Muslim men in New Delhi.
Well, but that's off the record. Later. That's outside the record. He said it was a statistical improbability. The judge concluded that it was a statistical improbability that the petitioner saw the same man at the Ahmedabad train station as in the New Delhi train station. And to which the petitioner replied when the judge kept asking him the question, "I know, I would recognize him anywhere. He came to my home to kill me." I think that the judge was acting outside the record. I think what we can say about the credibility finding from the judge's perspective is that, one, if you are a farmer from India, from a small village in Gujarat, you're not a refugee, you don't have any political opinion. If you come from a small farming family in the state of Kota, you are a subsistence farmer, and therefore you couldn't possibly get $7,000 together to flee India to the United States. And if you are a farmer in the village of Kota, you are not an important person, you're not a national figure, and therefore nobody would persecute you. And if you come from a small farming village and you're helping your father farm, you are therefore not so important enough that anything that was done to you by three Muslim thugs was going to be reported in the Ahmedabad newspapers. That's basically what sums up the credibility finding here, none of which relates to the facts.
But I'm having trouble with this whole idea that if somebody is roughed up in Crivitz, Wisconsin, and then says, I was in New York the other day and I saw the person who roughed me up, that doesn't seem like that's something that you could not doubt if you heard that.
Well, what if it was, in fact, a case of mistaken identity? That the man he saw at Ahmedabad might have been a man who was following him, but the man he saw in New Delhi a month or 3 days later might have been somebody else, but it looks so much like the man he saw. It resembles.
But the importance of it being the same man he saw is that they would go to great lengths to follow him and pressure him or beat him or intimidate him or something like that. Isn't that the...
Why wouldn't that happen? Why wouldn't he feel that way? Why wouldn't he think that the man he saw in Ahmedabad was one of the three men that beat him up, or the man that he saw in the New Delhi train station was the same guy that he saw in the Ahmedabad train station, which was the same guy that beat one of the three that beat him up? If you're looking for... One of the things we have to clarify here is that the police themselves were involved in stimulating much of the communal violence in Gujarat. And Gujarat was a particularly explosive state at the time when these incidences occurred. There was a great deal. The BJP party was in control of Gujarat and still is. There was a lot of communal violence, and there is plenty of literature in the record that shows that the police were an element instigating it. Why would they follow him to get more information? Probably because the circumstances in their minds, and I'm not saying that the men acted rationally, but the circumstances in their minds was that he had something that they wanted to know. And it was important for them politically, and it was important for them given the political climate at the time. That aside, the veracity issue, the reasons that the immigration judge gave to doubt his credibility were speculative. The fact that this guy was a farmer's son was irrelevant. The fact that he came from a state where there were equal numbers of Hindus, or maybe more Hindus than Muslims, and therefore this couldn't have occurred, is also irrelevant. The fact that his family was a subsistence farming was irrelevant. In fact, most of the cross-examination that was conducted by the judge didn't disclose anything. In fact, that last hearing, the October hearing, the final hearing, where the judge began his cross-examination, it seemed, at least to me, and I was representing the petitioner, that he had found that the petitioner had established persecution, went back to write his opinion, then came back out on the bench, decided he was going to cross-examine the petitioner, and came out with a totally different result. What had changed between the time that the petitioner presented his case and the judge had decided to conduct more cross-examination is mystifying. But there was an irregular aspect to these proceedings that prompted the judge, and I think the judge really acted from a preconceived bias against this young man and the fact that he came from India. Now, this is all I can explain because so much of the credibility findings are not rational, in my view. They're not... They have a lot to do with this judge's perception of where this class standing, what this young man's class standing was in India vis-a-vis anybody else, or his importance in India, or his political associations in India. You know, this court has said repeatedly that asylum is not for the just the famous or the notorious. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Ms. Fasciati. And Ms. Ritt?
May it please the court. My name is Erica Ritt, and I represent the Attorney General in this matter. The only issue before this court is whether or not the evidence compelled the immigration judge to find that the petitioner testified credibly. Petitioner's counsel has raised a litany of other claims, some of which were never exhausted, such as the immigration judge's conduct during the hearing. And some were simply not previously decided and did not need to be, such as the merits of petitioner's asylum claim, which petitioner here concedes was not articulated properly. But if we focus on the single issue of credibility, we see that the immigration judge and the Board of Immigration Appeals properly found that petitioner's allegations just don't make sense. And there was certainly a rational basis for that conclusion. Before I start discussing, however, the credibility issues, I do want to clarify an incorrect statement regarding something the immigration judge has been attributed to the immigration judge. A paragraph on page 5 of petitioner's reply brief, which she has also referenced today, it cites to the record at page 219. That is incorrectly attributed to the immigration judge. It's the paragraph where the immigration judge, we were speculated that the immigration judge was making the quoted remarks as an indication of his initial positive reaction to petitioner's arguments. However, a review of the record shows that those remarks were not made by the immigration judge at all, but rather they were made by petitioner's counsel.
That whole quote on?
The whole quote is by petitioner's counsel. It's her closing argument. Hopefully that clears up the mystery of why the immigration judge may have indicated that he was leaning towards the petitioner and then come back and conducted the cross-examination and come to a different conclusion. He never made that initial indication. Having clarified that, I want to move on to credibility issues, if there are no questions on that. As this court has found, credibility is the linchpin of a well-founded fear claim. Eligibility for asylum cannot be established if the factual assertions upon which the claim are based are not truthful. Even beyond the fact that petitioner's story here is inherently implausible, the inconsistencies in his testimony are quite revealing, and there are several. The one that I find the most amazing is that petitioner can't get his story straight as to whether or not he was shot at. This is something that you'd remember. Petitioner, in his application, said that the mystery men, these Muslim men, shot at both himself and his father in the field on this alleged second field visit. He said that in his application, and he said that when he was cross-examined by the immigration judge in October. But at the original April hearing date, twice on direct examination, he never said anything about being shot at. He said they waved the weapons at him. Waving weapons versus being shot at, that's a big difference and not something that one is likely to forget. He also can't decide if it was days, as he said in his application, or weeks, as he said in his testimony, between the first alleged field fire and field visit and the second visit. He can't even remember properly whether his parents were locked in the same room as he was during that last alleged beating, or if they were locked in a different room, or if the beating lasted 30 minutes, or if the beating lasted 2 hours. Even beyond the fact that his story doesn't make sense, that he's speculating that he saw someone at Grand Central, the equivalent of Grand Central Station, he's got inconsistencies in his argument, and it just doesn't hang together. Also, the immigration judge properly found the petitioner's claim regarding his need to relocate India also does not withhold scrutiny. Just to clarify, because petitioner made an issue of this in the brief, the relocation is not relevant at this point as an alternative to seeking asylum here in the United States, but rather as it demonstrates yet another credibility problem. As the immigration judge noted, the size and diversity of India would have offered many opportunities for escape. It's incredibly unlikely that petitioner could have been found in a country of a billion people, especially with the $7,000 head start his parents supposedly gave him. Also, petitioner's claim that his parents, that the men could have tracked him through communication with his parents is questionable. Since August of 2001, he only talked to his parents three times. Talked to them once. Two letters. Three communications.
I believe that somewhere in the record, he maintains that he is fearful of trying to reach them.
When he was in New Delhi, he said he was fearful of trying to reach them, but since he has been here in the United States, there's nothing, Your Honor, I respectfully believe in the record that indicates that he was fearful of contacting them since he's been in the United States.
Well, he's fearful for them.
Your Honor, I don't recall that in particular. I know that his parents said that they were fearful for their situation and asked him to leave at that point. So I don't know if that's perhaps what the reference was to. Petitioner has made much of the immigration judge's reference to the petitioner as a farmer. And I think that that's being mischaracterized.
What page of the certified administrative record was the quote that you said was misquoted?
219.
Go ahead.
Okay. When the judge discussed the fact that petitioner was a farmer, it went to his relative profile. Petitioner's counsel is absolutely right. Asylum doesn't just exist for people who are high profile. However, because petitioner's argument was that people knew me, they came and sought me out, they tracked me around India, a country of a billion people, profile becomes relevant. It's not a dismissive. It's not a derogatory.
Can you point me to the portion of the record where Patel admits being an arriving alien? Do you know where that is? Because what I was wondering was if he didn't realize that by admitting the allegations in the NTA, he was conceding his ineligibility for voluntary departure, whether it would be appropriate to remand for the IJ to determine if he would grant Patel voluntary departure.
The admission is on the record at page 106. And he was represented by counsel at the time he made that admission. And then he was later represented by counsel during his hearing. And that admission was part of the record already at that point, and counsel chose not to withdraw that admission. But I think it's important that he was represented by counsel when that admission was made. Also, I want to address the fact that in petitioner's reply brief, issues were raised regarding the immigration judge's conduct during the hearing, the fact that the immigration judge took an active role in questioning petitioner. First and foremost, this issue was not raised in the opening brief, and this court has found that failure to make any argument in an opening brief with respect to a particular claim constitutes waiver. So this issue is not properly before the court. But even beyond that, the immigration judge has broad discretion to examine witnesses and control questioning. The immigration judge has a duty to control the courtroom. The hearing was conducted in conformity with statutory and regulatory requirements, and the petitioner had a full and fair opportunity to be heard. Also, petitioner has speculated that respondent's reference to Ventura and the need that this case would have to be remanded if there is an issue with the credibility finding. Petitioner took that as a concession. Just to clarify, that most certainly wasn't a concession. It was a statement of the law. In summary, Petitioner did not testify credibly. His story does not make sense and is riddled with inconsistencies. Since he did not testify truthfully, he cannot be found eligible for asylum. For these reasons, the Attorney General respectfully requests this court dismiss the petition for review.
Thank you, Ms. Ford.
Thank you.
Ms. Fasciotti, a minute.
As I understand it, Judge Bauer is looking up page 219, and I remember reading this twice. I hope I haven't lost my mind completely, but it seemed to me that the judge had interposed his view because he wanted to cut my closing argument short. If I'm wrong on that, I will admit error, but I remember reading this.
219 does not bear out your position.
Excuse me?
219 does not bear out your position.
Well, then, I apologize to the court.
I wondered if my question was going to be, is there any other place in the record with the judge?
There probably, I don't have the record in front of me, Your Honor.
The record before me says on page 219, and I'm quoting you, says I think he has established more than a casual concern about his life, liberty, and well-being. He goes back to his town. And the court has, and the judge interrupts and says you run out of tape. We'll put a new tape in, and then you continue.
If I may have time to see if I can search the record when I get back to the office, I didn't bring it with me. But if I am wrong, I apologize to the court, but I remember reading this several times. Let me say one thing in response to this voluntary departure.
Why don't we give you 7 days or 10 days?
I will be more
days.
Than happy to because
we'll
I
give
would,
you 10 days.
To I was almost, I try to read these records very carefully, and I don't want to misinterpret.
We'll give you 10 days to either, you know, send something in regardless.
Judge,
well, if you read the quote on page 5 of the reply brief, it certainly doesn't sound like the judge is saying that.
I wouldn't set that thing out in that way if I didn't read that transcript several times. I wouldn't do any. I mean, I just simply wouldn't distort the record that way.
And all three of us know that.
Thank you.
And I hope the government knows that as well.
I have one more point to make. When Mr. Sanders represented the respondent, he had an incorrect asylum application. He showed that he had come into the United States twice, once through Atlanta, Georgia, and once through St. Thomas. And based on that, Mr. Sanders admitted that he was not admissible, which was wrong, and I had asked the judge to correct that. Somewhere along, and it was an important correction because he would have had more than a year in filing his asylum application with the Chicago office. I would ask the court that we didn't argue this voluntary departure issue because I wasn't certain that the court could consider it. I know that the court has raised it, but it was my recollection that there was something wrong with the way the asylum application was drafted, and I will go back to my office and look at the record again. I apologize.
Thank you. All right. Thanks to Ms. Fasciotti and to Ms. Ritt. And the case will be taken under advisement.